Hello, are you past your mental peak or getting smarter every day? I'm Richard Kilgariff and this is my Bookomi podcast for leaders who are readers. In this episode, a world-leading neuroscientist, neurosurgeon, author and TV presenter wants a book that makes him think about the changing mind. Okay, so let's go and find our guest.
Be outside somewhere.
How are you?
That was the easiest walk. How are you, man?
Nice to see you.
Thanks for including me. Hi.
Come down into Fraggle Rock.
I like this.
We're not taking you down here to kidnap you and keep you in the basement.
This is the quietest room
in the whole building.
Welcome. Today, I'm in the basement of Whitehall Court, very close to the corridors of power in Westminster, the neural networks of the nation, if you like. And I'm with a man who is both brain surgeon and brain scientist. From his base at the City of Hope in Los Angeles, he performs life-saving surgery on cancer patients and leads a team of research scientists in a lab named after him. He is, befitting a polymath, also the author of a best-selling book, Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon. He is Rahul Jandial. Welcome, Rahul.
Oh, what a pleasure to be here.
We were just talking about how you travel around the world and how you are in Bogota 1 minute, you're in LA the next, you're in London today. How do you keep your clock, how do you keep your brain working?
Well, if it's a short trip, I don't actually break what I call LA time. So here in London, I went to bed at 4 a.m. And I wake up at 9 a.m. and it just feels like an early morning in Los Angeles. So I try to stay on home time to keep fresh when I travel, unless I'm gone for more than a week, and then I will adjust to the new time zone.
I'm so glad we stayed in touch. We met last year, because your work is applicable and relevant to almost everything we choose in life and the choices we make. And the choice you've made for your most wanted choice is about the brain, for, you know, appropriately, The Changing Mind, A Neuroscientist's Guide to Aging Well by Daniel Levitin. How do you feel about talking about other neuroscientists' work? I know you're a dual-trained neuroscientist and surgeon, but do you feel comfortable talking about other people's work, or are you judgmental?
I'm both. I'm comfortable talking about other people's work, but at the same time, I'm from Los Angeles. There are a lot of self-declared experts out there, and anyone with a brain, I guess, should be allowed to speak of the brain. But what it does is it takes something complicated and makes it too simple. So it's a bit of a challenging landscape for me to navigate, because sometimes I say something and people say, hey, wait a second, that's amazing. Is that going on in your laboratory? I'm like, no, that's been on our books for 40 years. That you can do awake brain surgery. They think it's some sort of pioneering technique, but it was done 60, 70 years ago. And then I hear things in Los Angeles like, this is where creativity lives, as if it's a nodule or a grape somewhere inside our brain that gets activated or turned on. No, creativity requires the entire brain. So I'm always redirecting new concepts and trying to shatter established things that are just are untrue about us. And then the brain science is interesting because a lot of changes have happened in the last two decades. For about 100 years, it was about the same. You have what you have, and if you lose brain cells, that's all you got. And then in the last 20 years, things started to change at the same time where I got my PhD in brain science. So it's an interesting confluence of events, enough patient interaction plus new riveting science that's out there. So I chose this one because I like the title, The Changing Mind, which goes against 100 years of dogma, really, that the brain is inflexible. So I thought that was a provocative and accurate title, Daniel Levitin's The Changing Mind.
So let's hear from Daniel Levitin and his Omi for Bookomi.
Here's three things I know about aging well. The first thing is the brain continues to evolve from the day you're born, through infancy, childhood, adulthood, all the way up to the end of your life. And we can live well for longer if we can exploit what neuroscience has shown us about the ways in which the brain continues to grow. The second thing is problem solving and insight actually get better as we age, with every decade after 40. And there's no end in sight that we know of. Although we do lose some faculties, the brain slows down a little bit, we have aches and pains, it might be a little bit more difficult for us to find words. These are compensated for by increased problem-solving ability, pattern matching, and wisdom. Finally, we have new insights on the importance of social contact, of spending time with other people, especially younger people, as you age. Loneliness is the number one killer. It predicts poor health and death more than anything else after the age of 70. But loneliness is something that can be ameliorated by spending time, even in just 15 or 20 second doses, with people in your community in casual conversation, the hi, how are you kind of thing, even with strangers.
Okay, that was Daniel Levitin's The Changing Mind, his OMI for Bocomi. How does that insight and that title, The Changing Mind, how does it chime with your experience that we can change, that the mind can change as well as the brain? Obviously, the brain changes shape, but how does the mind change as we develop as human beings?
Yeah, to really think about that, and it's not out of his book. This is from my mind. I believe we are new every day. If we come to understand how the brain is constructed and the mind that arises from it, I think not only do we see everybody as individuals, you see yourself as an individual from your former self. If last night I won the lottery, I'm a different man today. If last night my job was threatened, or let's say I was attacked, I'm a different man today with the same brain. So I want to get away from the brain as this homogenous thing, and the mind even more is constantly changing. When you become a father, when you become a lover, all of these things change who we are. And the way that happens is really amazing, because the brain itself is not flesh like muscle or liver or heart. It's 3 pounds but gets 20% of the blood flow, yet is glistening white like a pearl. We don't know why. There is something unique about it. Unlike all the other elements in our body, the cells, like think of a sand castle made on the beach. It's made of small pieces of sand. Well, our brains and bodies are also made of cells. In the brain, these 90 billion cells, each shaped like a tiny jellyfish, they are tightly packed, but they never touch each other. The tentacles, as they come close to each other, spray chemicals to each other, dopamine, serotonin, these things that we've come to know. But when you think about it that way, 90 billion microscopic jellyfish floating inside your skull, spraying infinite amounts of chemical, you realize that is a completely, infinitely complex system allowing you to have a new mind any minute a new experience happens. And even more provocatively, if you start to steer that mind, if you start to think about, am I feeling what I should be feeling? And they call that emotional regulation. Am I responding the way I should be responding? So once you realize that this complexity actually lets you drive your thoughts and feelings, and you take the helm of your own life, I think that's the basis of what my mind would be, the changing mind.
And you are dual trained, so you hold brains in your hand. Which appeals to you most? Is it the theory or the science or the practice?
Well, it's interesting thing about brain surgery. It's the only flesh you actually don't hold in your hand. I've held hearts in my hand and livers and these sort of things. But brain surgery is a bit like ice fishing. You make holes in the skull and then you take instruments and you tinker and you slide around the valleys of the brain. So you at most, you just put a light finger on the surface, but it's usually done with instruments. And as far as what do I value the most, I think it's the intersection. So I'm half surgeon, 2 or 3 days a week I operate. And then the other couple of days a week, I'm a scientist. I have a laboratory. It's got petri dishes and looks like fog machines, like it's a TV show. But we are taking brain cells, sprinkling them in some primordial soup, if you will. And an individual brain cell, if you put them apart by space, they'll coalesce and come together. And then if you leave them alone for a week or two, you'll start to see little electrical sparks between them. And so imagine having that perspective, like visually looking at the human frontal lobes, those giant things that pushed our foreheads forward, and then looking under a microscope and seeing that the individual components, the neurons, they want to come together into a collective. And so that's the kind of range from which I draw content and stories for this book.
And we live in such a connected digital age where information can be digitized, received, given. Why did you, as a scientist and as somebody passionate about and continuously learning about the brain. Why did you choose the technology of a book to express your ideas? Because it's fairly ancient, solid. We've got to hear your life lessons from a brain surgeon, the new science and stories of the brain.
This completely caught me off guard. So I think for the listener and for the people that know me, I have no idea how I ended up here. I did not engineer this life. I'm delighted to be here, but I had dropped out of college. I was not a dedicated student. I got in a lot of trouble, nothing horrible, but you know, I was naughty when I was young. I was an adolescent. My frontal lobes were trying out a lot of different things. I dropped out of college and was a security guard. I went back to school and fell in love with surgery because it was tactile and there was ownership. A bag of medicine here in New York and LA is the same bag of medicine. It's made by a factory, but with my hands, I could do something that was only available with my hands. Like, I felt like in surgery, your hands can be a medicine that can't be simply purchased or manufactured elsewhere. So I love the ownership of talking to somebody, taking them to surgery if they wanted it, and then afterwards seeing how you did. It's like a painting. It's a sculpture that you have made. So I love that. It finally felt like a thrill to me. I was never meant to be somebody to write prescriptions and I'll see you in 6 weeks. To me, that would be boring. I wouldn't be good at that. It's important, but it's not what I wanted to do. And then I thought I was going into heart surgery. Then I jumped over to brain surgery. And then somehow I got a PhD in the process. Ended up in TV in Los Angeles accidentally.
It's not something people accidentally normally do, though. I mean, what did you want? What were you thinking of when you were a security guard? There's got to be some will. You must have pushed yourself into it.
There's no question I'm ambitious. It's just not in the way that my peers are ambitious when you see us in the same endpoint. So my ambition was to study human nature, to be curious, to put my best foot forward. I fell in love and was motivated by that. So I was ambitious, just not in the conventional way that is the protocol in the States on how somebody becomes a medic and does those other things. And the TV thing was accidental. The TV thing led to something else. And then it led to a literary agent. Because in LA, if you're on TV, that will move books. And when I had that opportunity, and this is a story very dear to me, I'm in love with London because London changed not just my mind, it changed my life. I had my unexpected death of my father about a year and a half ago. I had written this book. It didn't do well in the States, but somebody here from Penguin UK, Venetia Butterfield, had bought the manuscript, all the same words, but they changed while and whilst, and there were some subtleties, put a totally different cover on it and changed the title and put the word stories in there and life lessons. And now I feel like I have a responsibility to communicate these things because in this field of lectures and the talk circuit, I do find things that are inaccurate. And as with my patients, I'm not invested in what you choose to do with your life. I'm invested in making sure you have current, fair, honest information. And then if you want to make bad decisions or good decisions, that's up to you. I'm not in it to limit people's freedom intellectually or physically.
Do you want a biscuit? Yeah. Do you have digestives in America?
Liqueurs and different things like that? Or food?
No, not digestif. You're so sophisticated.
What is a digestive?
You're not in Malibu now, Rahul.
Oh.
Come on.
Well, they wouldn't know that there.
A digestive.
Digestive. That is the label that makes me not want to buy it. It's gonna either cause or relieve diarrhea. It's a digestive.
It makes you eat enough of them.
It's next to Pepto Bismol. excuse me. Biscuits everywhere.
Well, talking of stories and choices and decisions and advice you give, there's a great story in the book where I think it's William in his 90s when you're trying to advise him and you're being very respectful and he decides to have surgery. And just pulling back to the Changing Mind book, which is about process of aging and how that changes. You talk about old age and young age through the lens of the brain and neuroscience in Life Lessons. What goes through your mind when you're advising someone who's near the end of their life and you've got to perform life-threatening surgery? It's a big responsibility, obviously, not just in the moment of the surgery, but in the advice you give. How did that pan out, that discussion with William and his dad? Because he just came in with a painful arm, right?
Yeah, and he insisted on it. So I try to walk him away from it. But what was enlightening about the story is there are people that are remarkably sharp in thinking. My father was the same way. Into the 80s. He was, you know, early 90s.
Well, Kirk Douglas, he was still sharp, wasn't he?
Best-selling author after a stroke. So that's a brilliant comment. So let's zoom out a little bit. When we're born, we actually have more brain cells. So now we're at that cellular level, not anatomy, not electrochemistry, right, in between. That leaves us adaptive. And if we engage the world, those cells will remain. If we don't engage the world, those cells will wither. If you patch an eye on a kid, the part of the brain that's receiving input from that eye, it'll wither because the brain is using up so much energy, 20% of our blood flow, and it only weighs 3 pounds. So the brain wants to be efficient. If it's not using it, it will downregulate. It will let those areas wither. On the flip side, bigger brains and brain volume, all these things, it's not exactly right. It's just one component. So, it's Alzheimer's, we want to build our brain and we do this and the brain was thicker after doing these exercises. That's kind of a misperception. Let's take one example. On the other end is that physician that I operate on, was his brain looked shriveled. Once I opened the skull, it looked like it had fallen away from the skull, like a raisin versus a grape. And there's distance from the skull to actually seeing the brain, 2 centimeters. And that's where the blood collects that need to be drained. But he was sharp. He was extremely sharp. So you have brain that has lost volume, and he's brilliant. You have babies that have less brain cells, but then that's how we become mature and actually adults. So the story isn't as simple as brain volume. Brain volume and brain tissue, brain anatomy, the flesh, is it thin, is it big, is it rippled, is it not, is one part of the story.
Where do other people come into our brain? Because other people can create anxiety, but human relationships and connectivity in the brain is seen to enhance our longevity and keep us alive and changing, as you said. The whole point is commitment to change, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a complicated question, and I like it. If you're a loner and content with a cup of tea and a book, you're not hurting yourself.
Yeah.
If you're in your apartment wishing to be connected with your kids, wishing to be connected with an old lover, and you are letting the electrical waves, right? Because loneliness does not work at any of those 4 levels except the electricity and the chemistry at the bottom, right? Loneliness, and you can't think about it in the terms of flesh and anatomy. Mm. Loneliness, you can't think about it as like, cells. But it does change your electrochemistry. It does drift into depression. And so I think most people, as they get less young, my patients have told me don't say older, they benefit from seeing things on Facebook or Instagram with videos of their grandchildren and staying connected. But rest is an overstated element to me. Even a bit of anxiety from the social interaction can bring something out in you. And again, it goes back to the original point. Where's that thermostat set for your own emotional regulation? That's really the next concept in my mind is, I had an anxious interaction, or like I'm nervous to be on a new job or a new opportunity. That bit of anxiety that's appropriate and situational, that's a spark of life. That's good anxiety. The constant feeling of tension, just taking the tube home or sitting on the freeway, that is setting the anxiety thermostat too high. The phobias of being around people because you're so worried about what they're going to say or how you'll look, that's set too high. And what emotional regulation does is it doesn't make us all Zen Buddhist people who are tranquil throughout the day. I'm not even sure that's better for people. But it lets you take the reins of how you're feeling. And if you can tamp down negative emotions just a bit and make that a habit, an exercise, I think people will be surprised how much control they can get back into their lives about how they think and how they feel.
How has your mind changed in the last 10 years? And what's the single most important lesson you've learned about life doing what you do? No pressure, don't feel anxious.
No, I like that one. In the last 10 years, while I'm opening skulls, while I'm doing all those things we talked about, I am taken aback and surprised at how resilient cancer patients can be. Every time they see me, there's a scan. They even call it scan anxiety. Every time they see me, is there a cancer? If I have cancer, has it come back? If we're following it, have they grown? They live under tremendous, almost existential crises sometimes. Yet they drive in, and many of them are happy. And what I've learned from them is that if with a diagnosis of essentially terminal, even though I use that word anymore, cancer, you can continue to enjoy life and have constructive relationships, what has happened to the rest of the world that seems to be struggling and they don't have cancer? So to me, that's the greatest idea. There is something inside us that, I don't mean everybody, and I'm not talking about all 8 billion, but there's something inside us that can be harvested, channeled, controlled, enjoying life. Because my patients, they pass away. I get a lot of invitation to funerals. So in those few years at the end, they are resilient and often happy and navigating life in a surprisingly healthy way, at least with their minds and emotions and their attitudes. To me, that is the single most powerful thing that I have seen.
Have you applied that to your life?
Yeah, it's a short run. I mean, I'm 47, nothing is promised, and I've applied it to my life, I would say, just in the last year. When you see your father, I mean, I've helped a lot of people die. It's not a coarse word. But when you see your father, somebody you've known for 47 years, take their last breath, you realize there's a finish line for all of us. And now I have this, not desperation, but enthusiasm to leave my legacy. Not a building with my name on it, but my legacy as thought, immortality through a new way of thinking that helps not just the probably 10,000 people I'll have operated on or the 40,000 people that I've met, but through thinking and explaining, if I could get people to see themselves also in a new light, then I'll feel like I've done a lot of good in this short run that we all get.
Rahul Jandil, thank you very much for sharing your Most Wanted with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you for being a leader who's a reader, Rahul. And thank you, Daniel Leviton, for sharing your OMI with us today. This episode was a Feast Collective production for Book OMI. The producer is Sarah Cudden. The exec producer is Kate Taylor. I'm Richard Kilgariff. And if you've learned something new by listening today, some OMI of your own, and I hope very much that you have, then please do rate, review, and subscribe. It makes all the difference. And you can find a full list of my most wanted new nonfiction at bookomi.com, including Rahul Jandil's Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon and Daniel Leviton's The Changing Mind. And you can follow us on Twitter at bookomi and bookomi on Instagram. Bye-bye.